recording. Great, good. We'll
leave this banter for a while. I think that it's tantamount that you and I just talk. I don't really know the direction.
Not only is it tantamount, I would say it's bantamount.
That's good. That's good. You should use that.
Hi there. Thank you for joining us this fine evening, morning, afternoon, whenever you're choosing to listen to this. All times of the day are fine. I know that you've been really itching to hear about this week's podcast. Last week was a bit dark, I'll admit. So we thought we'd lighten it up, and we thought we'd talk about Southern cooking.
One of my favorite types of cuisine.
You know, I have a little anecdote from my childhood that I'd like to relate to you.
I would love to hear it.
Wonderful, good. So, the primary ingredient in Southern cuisine is, as you, the listener, will learn, love. But I have not yet professed to you my love for this stuff and why I chose it for tonight's podcast. So I recall going over to a friend's house in middle school. I forget his name, but I do remember that he looked like the sort of kid who should be named Brian, whatever his name really was.
Right.
I went over to his house, and after watching The Matrix, he asked me if I was hungry. I said, sure. And when I stepped into his family's kitchen, I immediately regretted my choice. There were dishes in the sink. There was a paper bag bereft of its lunch, just crumpled up on the ground. The trash can liner was too big for the trash can. It was just... You know, this was the kind of house that was clearly run by a hideous slob, no doubt his awful mother. And how could she cook anything of quality if she couldn't take care of her kitchen in the most fundamental sense? Mm. So, you know, when Brian was, you know, telling me about, you know, what a good cook his mom was, and, you know, how she had grown up in Kentucky, and how she was just great, all I could think was, no. And when he said fried chicken, I was truly horrified. You know, in my native Massachusetts, where I grew up, quality fried chicken was, of course, in extremely short supply. So I assumed that all fried chicken was absolutely horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
And after what felt like 2 to 6 hours of waiting for her to finish this dish, Brian's mother presented us with 2 pieces each of fried chicken on red plastic plates, which really just kind of sent home how morally impoverished they were. I took one bite. And it was hard to hold back the tears of joy. It was truly amazing. It was one of the best things I've ever eaten in my entire life.
Was that your first experience with fried chicken?
No, but I want it to be my last because that's how I'd like to remember fried chicken.
Well, has it been your last? Have you had fried chicken since? Have you chased that dragon?
I've chased the dragon, and it's never been the right one.
Mm.
Yeah. Brian and I never really clicked, and he never did return my VHS copy of The Matrix, but I will never, ever forget what fried chicken, made with 11 secret herbs and spices, peanut oil, and 2 cups of love, tastes like.
And I think that's a good place to start for tonight, since fried chicken is such a staple food among Southern cuisine. But in order to really get into this, we need to go back. And when I say back...
I mean way, way, way back.
Back before old school.
Back before there were schools. I'm talking about Neanderthal times. This is apparently when Southern cooking originated. As many of you might expect us to bring up, a barbecue is one of the chief methods of cooking for Southern cuisine. And it is tantamount to Southern cooking that you take a look at the history of it and how barbecue developed. And according to legend, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, silly legends that humanity has to describe, you know, how the elephant got its trunk or how the zebra got its stripes.
Sure, why the spider makes its web.
Why cockatoos never cry. Barbecue was first invented in the pre-Ice Age times when Neanderthals and humans lived near each other. And according to the earthly fable, a group of mammoths was caught in a sort of ring of cedar trees,
mm-hmm.
and lightning struck one of the trees, and they immediately were set ablaze, like a box of matches.
The trees?
The trees.
Like a domino effect surrounding the mammoths,
and
encircling them.
They surrounded the mammoths, and the trees started to topple over on one another, creating a beautiful ring of fire, and in fact, crushing many of the mammoths, breaking their bones, and tenderizing their soft, soft meats quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Cedar, as you know, burns to insanely hot hot temperatures. It can get up to 3,000-5,000 degrees, which melts bone, actually.
Oh.
It created, legendarily, the most succulent marrow sauce that was injected, in a way, into the meat as it was cooking.
Sort of like an internal basting.
Humans have tried to replicate this sort of basting technology, but they've never quite been able to do it. The only way to do it, really, is to cook a live animal at about 3,000-5,000 degrees.
Yeah.
And I, when I was in the Natural History Museum, they sell a variety of barbecue sauces to commemorate this.
They're expensive, though.
Although, as we will learn, Southern cooking does often have a reason to be as affordable and expensive as it is. Now, it didn't really stop there. The Native Americans were probably some of the most innovative individuals.
The Native Americans have actually been accredited with developing, or maybe not developing, but cultivating and perfecting what we now know today as pit barbecue.
They essentially, well, you did a little more research about this, Kevin. We did a lot of restaurant and barbecue touring in this episode. We went all across the country to really, really take it in. But Kevin spent a lot more time on barbecue than anything else.
Right. Native Americans would hunt down their own game. And then usually it would be shared among the community. And what better way to cook, to share it among the community than to cook it among the community, usually in an open pit fire, sometimes with bricks or
hot coals.
Yeah, hot coals, cedar. Hot cedar, wood chips.
It creates a nice smoky smell to it.
It does. It makes the whole village smell like fresh, like, delicious meat. And it also allows for what's called a pick and pull, which is where you can just go up to the meat on its skewer, spinning over the flame, and just pick off little bits and nibble on it.
And it falls off the bone, as it traditionally should. It was probably one of the most important communal practices, and it was really regarded as a sacred rite amongst the Native Americans. As we'll learn later, there were some really crazy ways they devised to barbecue that are fascinating, delicious, and highly dangerous.
Interesting.
One of the most dangerous things they did, which people still do today, aside from not wearing a shirt, which creates a lot of cuts, bruises, and burns, they had this one incredible one called the Iron Maiden. What it is you essentially tie a giant metal ball to a tree, and the ball can open up kind of like a clamshell, and it's covered in metal spikes. You skewer the meat on the spikes, and you fill the ball with molten hot lead, and then you just kind of gently, between you and another friend, just pass this metal ball. The swaying motion kind of keeps the meat tender, keeps it active, and prevents it from burning off.
And the force of the hands pushing the meat, I imagine, also does a good job to tenderize it.
Absolutely. It's just some of the softest stuff you can make, but the molten lead is extremely dangerous to handle, and some people don't like the taste of the fumes.
This is actually one of the things that has led to the downfall of Native Americans, and it's why they're so difficult to come by nowadays, is because of massive lead poisoning.
It's pretty tragic, but not nearly as tragic as what the slaves had to endure.
Native Americans engineered, and I said perfected, but that's not the right word. The slaves are really the ones that perfected it. While the slave masters would be dining on the finest, rarest meats,
octopus,
imported spices, delicious desserts,
fancy meads.
The slaves had to just eat whatever they could find, which was usually the leftovers, sometimes just the greens of better,
chopped off the top of a carrot or a turnip,
exactly,
or a collard.
Or they would have to hunt their own food, and when they did, they would cook it in a means similar to pit barbecue and have a big party. And this was great. It brought all the slaves together. It unified them all. And
what it really very strangely did, though, was it actually, in a way, unified the whole South. Because once the white slave masters caught on to this, and how could they not with all those wonderful smells wafting from it, they joined in. And it was probably one of the more, they were the most, allegedly, the most racially, culturally, and sexually diverse gatherings.
Right. In early American history. These early pit barbecues would have whites, blacks, Mexicans, women, children, people of all religions, races, genders, sexual preferences. They would all put it aside and come together and have a good time at these pit barbecues. And then when they were over, everyone would go back to
their traditional social roles of beating and
Yeah, exactly. Now, when it comes to the early American South, some of the crops that really stand out as helping build an economically stable environment were
tobacco,
corn, cotton. But two crops that were among every plantation in the early South that are sometimes forgotten today are sugarcane and lemons.
Now, these were not originally grown for their taste value at all.
No, they were grown for their martial purposes.
They were a disciplinary tool.
When a slave ran away or...
was disobedient in some way.
Right, the master would go to his sugarcane field and find the tallest, sturdiest sugarcane he could, and he would use it as a switch with which to lash the slaves. And then once the slave was lashed over their freshly... opened wounds.
He would slice lemons in half and pelt them with the fresh lemon slices, mm-hmm. which would burn and hurt terribly.
I mean, you can imagine how terrible this would be if you've ever even gotten a little bit of lemon juice in a tiny cut on your hand.
But human beings, when they're driven to dire circumstances, always find ways to, well, make lemonade out of lemons.
And that's exactly what the slaves did. To kind of rub it in the face of their slave masters, they would take lemons and the sugar cane and just add a little bit of water and develop what we now know today as lemonade.
Of course, these slave masters sort of took this drink and ran with it.
How could they not? I mean, it's so refreshing and delicious.
It does dry your mouth out a little bit.
This inadvertently helped the economic growth of the South as well as the slave trade and was the primary reason for the great whip boom of 1834.
Lemonade wasn't really the only beverage, though, that I think is really important in Southern cuisine.
Whiskey is pretty much its own food group in Southern cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is whiskey its own food group, but in both Kentucky and Tennessee, they have a special kind of whiskey called bourbon. Which, like something such as champagne, has a regional identity. Bourbon can only be made in Kentucky and Tennessee.
Now, whiskey, a lot like corn, is one of the most important ingredients in Southern cuisine, and it's in almost everything to a pretty, I would say, almost illegal degree. They don't really cook it down, and it is quite potent.
Almost all Southern cooking has whiskey in it, but...
instead of water, usually, yeah, whiskey is used.
But over the years, this, you know, with alcohol laws and such, it's something that police have kind of turned a blind eye to. Like, jaywalking, they've got better things to do. Everyone knows that there's whiskey in pretty much all Southern food. We allow it because it's part of the experience.
Well, there's lots of different dishes that have developed as a result of it. We have your classic Jack Daniel's barbecue mm-hmm. sauce. You have bourbon-flavored Mountain Dew now. And you even have Evan Williams tooth whitening toothpaste. It's pretty magical.
Uh-huh. And it's a really good way. It's really, you can feel it working while you're sleeping. That's what I use, personally.
Burning and cleaning simultaneously.
Right. And speaking of the burning, and you mentioned this earlier, one of the primary ingredients in bourbon, which is cultivated from corn, is love. The love within bourbon is what makes for that warm, tingly feeling that it gives you. Unlike Canadian whiskey, which is made from...
crushed maple leaves.
Which gives it that smoothness or sharpness, depending on what type of you get. Or
Scotch whiskey, which is made out of the blood of one's enemies.
Which is why you get those otherworldly effects from drinking it.
Now, if you want to take the edge off of the whiskey, you can always have yourself a glass of sweet tea.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet tea's a pretty interesting beverage. In an attempt to understand the elderly in a more, Kay and I decided that we would be drinking more tea more often.
Yeah.
So...
it's been tough.
Yeah, it's... well, let me just describe to you the characteristics of sweet tea. First of all, it's just crazily ubiquitous. Anywhere you can get a beverage, you can get sweet tea.
Which is pretty much everywhere.
So you can get sweet tea anywhere.
Pretty much.
It's brown. It is extremely cold. It produces sweat on the glass. It smells curiously neutral. Mm-hmm. More neutral than water, actually.
That's right.
It is a high viscosity engine lubricant, and it is undrinkable.
Which is why it's very often served with lemon.
To cut the edge off of the undrinkability of the sweet tea. I don't think it works, personally.
Right.
But some people are partial to it.
And I think that's a pretty good time for us to take a little break for a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Timothy Tinkles, and I'm taking my sound waves to the airwaves. It's that time of the year, that's right, our annual Memorial Day blowout. What better way to memorialize our brave servicemen and servicewomen than a handcrafted chime tombstone guaranteed to turn a graveyard into a raveyard? We've got 6-foot clompers for $16.99 a pair. Pewter Piccolo Pipe Packs, buy one, get one half off. Tin Troublemakers for $10 a piece. All of our chimes are made in-house by our cheery chime smiths. Give them a Timothy Tinkles greeting, guys. So come on down to the Ridge Avenue Mini Mall. And like we say here at Timothy Tinkles,
So I mentioned love before, which is a spice similar to something like rosemary in its robustness. Even though it's plentiful, it's elusive and difficult to come by. It's also a very, not always, but it's a very good ingredient in cornbread. Love, not rosemary. Cornbread is a southern food staple.
It is in every region of southern cuisine, you will find cornbread.
Cornbread was originally developed out of necessity from corn kernels found on the ground, left over from picking corn, I imagine. Later, the corn would be thrown into a pan with other crops such as cotton and tobacco, a bit of cornstarch, and baked. Initially, it was only bearable because of the copious amounts of love with which it was made. But over the generations, the recipe was refined, and now it has become the inflammable, unaddictive, delicious concoction that we know of today. Pie.
Pie is possibly the most commonly stolen item in the United States.
Old women who cook pies will often
naively
leave them on their windowsill to cool, tempting neighbors and animals from afar.
To snatch one, two, or eight slices of tasty blueberry, cherry, or Georgian peach pie.
Mm-hmm.
We read Life on the Mississippi as we were driving across country to all these restaurants, and Mark Twain wrote extensively about his experiences as riverboat captain and child pie thief in this book. In his spirit, Kevin and I decided to go to our local bakery and be a bit mischievous ourselves and snatch a couple of pies.
Yeah. We were supposed to get one each, but we went a little overboard.
Yeah. There's a litany of pies in this studio right now.
Too many.
And they're hot, and I don't mean like temperature-wise.
But they are hot temperature-wise. There's so many, and they're so hot that they are actually heating the room that we are in up. But we have pies of all sorts here, and they're all fresh. And these are all southern staples, too. We have pecan pie.
Boysenberry. Huckleberry.
Lime. Key lime pie. Chocolate fudge.
Milk thistle.
Pumpkin. Apple pie. Strawberry rhubarb pie. But Taylor, let me ask you something.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that pie is so well beloved that it has found its way into every course of a southern meal?
I did not know this.
Yeah, think about it. That's why we have things like beef, turkey, or chicken pot pie, shepherd's pie, fried chicken pot pie, chicken fried chicken pot pie, chicken fried steak pot pie, turkey fried chicken style beef and steak pot pie with turkey gravy. And even...
You're drinking a cup of bourbon pie.
Yes,
right
I am.
But
you can actually
get
bourbon pie in certain places. That's what... If you've ever seen on a menu in a restaurant, Kentucky or Tennessee pie, it's bourbon pie. And that is actually what I'm currently drinking right now. And it is delicious. Mm. And it goes really well with the pecan pie, especially.
Now, speaking of Kentucky... Southern cooking is a pretty regional thing. Like, people like to think of the southern United States as one individual block.
Uh-huh.
But it's very multifaceted and quite multivarious.
And even the region itself has sub-regions
within it.
Such as Tex-Mex or Floribian.
Mm-hmm. But we're going to talk about the most important thing right now, which is Cajun food.
Cajun, which comes from southeastern Louisiana.
It is absolutely dreadful. I do not like shellfish. And Cajun food seems to be primarily shellfish. It's in pretty much everything.
A lot of shellfish, a lot of rice.
A lot of corn, a lot of okra, a lot of spiciness. It is made with a lot of love, but not nearly enough love to cover up the shellfish taste. It is in their bread. It is in their rice. It is in their vegetables. It is in their beer. I could not find even a creek to drink out of that wasn't infested with crawdads.
What's a crawdad?
A crawdad?
Yeah.
Oh, well, a crawdad is essentially, you know how there's like a queen ant?
Sure.
Well, the king of the crawfish is the crawdad. He produces all of them.
Oh, like crawdad.
Yes, he's literally the dad of all the various crawfish. They're very big, very dangerous.
Are they? They're not very tasty, though?
They're quite tasty, but their meat is tough. They're muscular guys.
Okay, well, I mean, I brush with Evan Williams, so I should be all right.
I think you'll be able to take it. Now, we mentioned Floribian food.
Floribian.
There you go. A little bit earlier. And you might be a little confused. You might think, is he saying Floridian food? No, I'm saying Floribian.
It's a combination of Florida and Caribbean.
Which are two very volatile cuisines by themselves. And when you combine them, when you do Florida and Caribbean fusion, you get pretty dangerous, unpleasant stuff. I'm going to be very honest with you. Florida is a dangerous, hot, tempting and confusing place, and subsequently its cuisine is quite similar.
Oh, one of the biggest problems with going to a Floribian restaurant is that you don't get a menu.
You were just asked yes or no.
And that's it.
The waiter walks up to you and says, well, and you're expected to answer. I asked if they had Crystal Light. None. Not a single Floribian restaurant has Crystal Light.
No, we had to settle for sweet tea.
Kevin received in front of him probably the most terrifying dish I've ever seen. It was just a giant, what looked like a shield of iron, scalding hot.
Yeah.
He's getting incensed just thinking about it. It was covered in a variety of local organic...
swamp grass.
Swamp grass and plant matter, coarsely chopped into random chunks. Some pieces were grilled, others were fried. But the scariest thing about this dish, it never cooled down.
And I had to eat it. They also will not let you leave the restaurant until you eat everything on your plate.
So
that was the most horrifying part of it for Taylor, but he didn't eat any of it. So he doesn't even know.
Kevin sucked it up and ate my meal for me. I really owe him a solid.
But he drove all the way back, and I slept for literally 34 hours on the way home. So it all kind of worked out. I think you've paid it back enough.
Thank you. If the Floridians are so hostile, that leads me to wonder where the phrase Southern hospitality comes from.
Well, it's quite simple, really. It comes, once again, from the pit barbecue party scene. And Southern hospitality is something that runs deep in Southern cuisine. If you go to most Southern restaurants, it's a little bit tougher when you're going into Floribian and Tex-Mex territory because they have different traditions. But most Southern restaurants that you go to are so hospitable that the people there will get you fresh, house-made buttermilk biscuits, lemonade, and bourbon before your butt even reaches the seat.
Even the cheapest restaurants had the most stellar service I'd ever received in my entire life.
The staff, from everyone from the busboy to the person who owns the place, are likely, in fact, yeah, likely to come by your table while you eat and start up a conversation about whatever. There might be a point during your meal where you're talking to the entire restaurant staff, which will lead you to wonder
who's cooking the food.
But you know, you're going to be having a good time, and
it's really matter. So charming.
And another important, this is very important in Southern cuisine, is that at the end of a meal
you get a hug.
It's important to hug people, and in a lot of Southern restaurants they encourage the wait staff to offer the first hug.
It was really sweet. I felt very awkward because I said I'm from Massachusetts, so I'm not familiar with this hugging tradition.
But they don't discriminate, and they will hug someone from a northern state such as Massachusetts may be initially kind of taken aback by this hospitality, but it all comes out of a place of love, just as the food does. And really the goal of this gesture is that Southern food has this quality of
where it gives you love and warmth inside.
It warms you on the inside, and the hug warms you on the outside. So the goal of the hug at the end of the meal is to feel like you're being hugged inside and out, and I just think that's beautiful.
It's precious. I think it's about time that we take a break and hear a word from one of our sponsors. Kevin, what are you doing?
What's it look like?
You can't smoke in here.
Why is that?
Well, I don't think the owner would like it. There's scented recording equipment and secondhand smoke. Well, it tends to, you know...
You sound tense. You need to relax.
How am I going to relax with you polluting my air with your smoke?
I know. How about a cigarette?
I don't know. Don't those lead to cancer, heart disease, and emphysema?
Sometimes.
And won't it speed up the aging process and make me smell bad?
Sure, maybe. But you look cool smoking them.
Yeah?
Not to mention it's a great social icebreaker.
Really?
And they have no adverse effects whatsoever.
Is it really that good?
They're so good, they're addictive.
All right, give me one.
Take two. Trust me, you'll want the other one. Cigarettes. Better than cash for over 200 years.
Now, you may be wondering, I live in Canada. There's a north of Canada and there's a south of Canada. Don't I technically have a form of Southern cuisine? And while Southern American chefs would say that you are wrong, I found that there is Southern food at any latitude in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere you go that is geographically south of a different location is going to have more soulful, more loving, more corn and whiskey-filled food than the place before.
For example?
Well, for instance, South Canadian food is significantly more palatable than Northern Canadian food, which consists mostly of bear and badger meat and various furs.
And things that are pickled.
If you go even further north to the Arctic zone, you'll find no food at all. There's literally nothing to eat.
Just a few polar bears wandering around looking
for the
food.
Last scraps that might remain in that region.
Whatever it may be, as unappetizing as it may be.
And trust me, there's none. However, conversely, if you go take a little trip down to Antarctica, you will be absolutely flabbergasted at what they have there. Antarctica is usually thought of as a barren and hostile place, but the chefs who live at McMurdo Station, which we visited, cook what many consider to be the finest cuisine in the world.
And I can't disagree with that.
They have unparalleled access to shellfish, very lax regulations regarding what is legally considered a chicken, and as a result, you can get some of the most succulent dishes imaginable.
Mm-hmm. And one of a big ingredient in Antarctic, which is, we'll say, even maybe the truest form of southern cooking, is seal milk.
Oh, God. Seal milk, I don't know if you know this, is about 80% fat. It's extremely fatty milk, and it results in some of the most phenomenal brie you could possibly have.
It's very difficult to milk a seal, but
they don't like it.
It's very well worth it. And if you go down to Antarctica and you stay at this research laboratory, they it's kind of a rite of passage. They won't let you
leave unless you milk the seal.
Yeah, they won't let you leave until you've milked a seal.
Now, sometimes you will notice that southern chefs seem very hostile to northern chefs in America. You know, they call it the war between the states. Well, in every country, this really does apply. Southern Australians, for example, refuse to use any food from Northern Australia, which seems like a very terrible idea, considering that their cuisine consists primarily of walnuts, kangaroo meat, and tumbleweeds. Fortunately, the enormous quantity of love in this food keeps the restaurant scene pretty lively.
Now, you may say to yourself, "There's in those foods that Tate has just listed, there's simply not enough necessary vitamins, minerals, and amino acids and proteins and such, but the love really does make up for that."
However, I will say, do not, under any circumstances, mention Outback Steakhouse around these people. 100% of the time, no matter who you are talking to, there will be trouble. So South Australia seems like a pretty dangerous place to be, but southern cooking in general is pretty dangerous.
And why is that?
Well, there's a lot of health risks towards eating southern food.
Sure. People who eat southern food more than 5 times a week have been found to have a 40% higher chance of both heart disease and stroke.
Southern food is incredibly fatty. Rather than using really lean cuts of meat, they only use the fatty ones. They use a lot of lard, butter, and eggs.
Fatback. Bacon.
They have glasses of bacon grease on every table. The candles are made out of bacon grease. It's a fatty, fatty place, and it's pretty dangerous. But surprisingly, one of the most dangerous things I discovered was that actually in southern baking, which you would consider to be free of meats, Generally,
yeah. It's more in the green bean corn casserole department.
Actually, the most popular and delicious binder in southern cuisine is not eggs, but mercury.
You don't say.
Yeah, mercury's rich, creamy, and subtle sweetness. They had such a wonderful complex flavor, and they bind things together so well that it's really hard for southern chefs to figure out a way to not use it in traditional dishes.
I've read in Reader's Digest once that mercury is the sweetest of the transition metals.
Unfortunately, you should be limiting yourself to 1 or 2 cups of mercury per day. So be careful, be on the watch, and try to stay healthy. Okay?
Just monitor your mercury intake. It's really not tough nowadays with all the technology that we have. So southern food is usually very delicious, and before we move on, we do need to say one last thing, which is that we, once again, have a bounty of pies on our hands, and there's no way that we're going to eat all of them before they go bad.
So if you would like a slice, two slices, or even a whole pie, simply send a certified letter with a appropriately sized Ziploc baggie with your address written on it, and we'll be happy to mail you as much pie as we can, because we do not want to get in trouble for the pies we have.
And I think we did it.
I think we covered everything.
I think we're good.
Yeah. No stone left unturned there.
Taylor, I've got some listener mail for you.
Wonderful.
Because it's about that time. Mm. This listener mail is quite a quandary, and I'm going to need your help with it, Taylor.
Sure.
This comes from Kelly in Beaverton, Oregon. Mm. Kelly writes, I really enjoyed your podcast on the elderly. Thank you very much, Kelly.
We worked hard.
It worked a treat on my gout. My question is about my father, who is growing older and now wants to move in with me. How do I let him know that I love and support him, but do not support his decision to become elderly? Thanks, Kelly.
You know, Kelly, I think you're going to have to face the fact that if you don't support his decision, then you don't support him. And you don't support him as a person.
Yeah, I don't think that you can find a delicate balance between those two. I think it's really a black or white situation. And it sounds to me like you don't support his decision to be old. And if that's the case, you're not going to.
You're not
going
to support the kind of person who would make that decision either. So don't. Don't feel obligated to.
Especially if they're living with you, you know, sleeping till 1 in the afternoon, waking up, taking a nap.
Going to bed at 7 in the evening.
Using the restroom 5-6 times a day.
It's going to be a very uncomfortable experience for you, so I honestly would recommend sticking him in a nursing home.
Yeah, Kelly, I would just say, just say no.
Ship up, shape out, and enjoy your youth while you decide to still have it.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Tay.
I'm Kay.
And join us next week when we talk about gravity.
This episode of Know It All with Tay and Kay was brought to you by Alternating Current.